Om Vishnupad Vanamansa Paribhajakacharya Sodara Sarashi Srimad Divine Grace Hesi Bhakti Vedanta Goswami Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. Jayam Vishnupad Vanamansa Paribhajakacharya Sodara Sarashi Srimad Divine Grace Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. Anantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Sakho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadara Srivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gopinath Shyam Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai. Sri Sri Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. Sri Sri Namrit Dham Ki Jai. Sri Sri Mayapur Dham Ki Jai. Sri Sri Mathura Dham Ki Jai. Sri Sri Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai. Tulasi Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Ganga Maya Ki Jai. Jamuna Maya Ki Jai. Gaur Premanandi, Harinam Sankirtana Ki Jai, Shri Shri Brihat Madanga Ki Jai, Transcendental Prasadam Distribution Ki Jai, Shri Shri Gornitai Ki Jai, Shri Jagannatha Baladev Subhadra Ki Jai, Shri Shri Radha Girit Hare Ki Jai, Shri Shri Nugordan Dham Ki Jai, Shamaveda Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, I thought we were reading from a different canto. The story of Maharaj Rahugana, that's what Vaikuntha told me. Yeah. Maybe. I think it. Oh, okay. That's it. Maybe that's it. In any case, we'll proceed with this one. Okay. Shastavi Gopta Nipati Pajanam Ya kinkaro vai na pinnashti pishtam sva dharmam arhadhanam achutasya yad ihamano vijahati aghogam shastabi goptanribati prajanam Shastabhi Gopta Nripati Prajanam Yakinkaro Vaina Pinashti Pishtam Yakinkaro Vaina Pinashti Pishtam Svadharma Maradhana Machutasya Svadharma Maradhana Machutasya Yad ihamano vijahat yakogham. Yad ihamano vijahat yakogham. Abhigopta, a well wisher of the citizens as a father, is the well wisher of his children. Nripati, the king. Prajanam, of the citizens. Ya, one who. Kinkara, order carrier. Vai, indeed. Na, not. Pinashtipishtam, grinds what is already ground. Svadharmam, one's own occupational duty. Aradhanam, worshipping. Achyutasya, of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yat, which. Ihamana, performing. Vijahati, they are released from. Agrogam, all kinds of sinful activity and faulty action. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. My dear sir, you have said that the relationship between the king and the subject, or between the master and the servant, are not eternal. But although such relationships are temporary, when a person takes the position of a king, his duty is to rule the citizens and punish those who are disobedient to the laws. By punishing them, he teaches the citizens to obey the laws of the state. Again, you have said that punishing a person who is deaf and dumb is like chewing the chewed or grinding the pulp. That is to say, there is no benefit in it. However, if one is engaged in his own occupational duty, as ordered by the Supreme Lord, his sinful activities are certainly diminished. Therefore, if one is engaged in his occupational duty by force, he benefits because he can vanquish all his sinful reactions, all his sinful activities in that way. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. This argument offered by Maharaja Hugana is certainly very effective. In his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Srila Rupa Goswami says, Tasmat kenap pipayena mana krishne niveshaye. Somehow or other, one should engage in Krishna consciousness. Actually, every living being is an eternal servant of Krishna, but due to forgetfulness, a living entity engages himself as an eternal servant of Maya. As long as one is engaged in Maya service, he cannot be happy. Our Krishna consciousness movement aims at engaging people in Lord Krishna's service that will help them become freed from all material contamination and sinful activities. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 4.10, Vita Raga Vaya Krodha. By becoming detached from material activities, we will be freed from fear and anger. By austerity, one becomes purified and eligible to return back home, back to Godhead. The duty of the king is to rule his citizens in such a way that they can become Krishna conscious. This would be very beneficial for everyone. Unfortunately, the king or president engages people in sense gratification instead of the Lord's service, and such activities are certainly not beneficial for anyone. King Rahugana tried to engage Jadbharat in carrying the palanquin, which is a form of sense gratification for the king. However, if one is engaged as a palanquin carrier in the Lord's service, that is certainly beneficial. In this godless civilization, if a president engages people somehow or other in devotional service or the awakening of Krishna consciousness, he renders the very best service to the citizens. I'll read the verse again. My dear sir, you have said that the relationship between the king and the subject, or between the master and servant, are not eternal, but although such relationships are temporary, when a person takes the position of a king, his duty is to rule the citizens and punish those who are disobedient to the laws. By punishing them, he teaches the citizen to obey the laws of the state. Again, you have said that punishing a person who is deaf and dumb is like chewing the chewed or grinding the pulp. That is to say, there is no benefit in it. However, if one is engaged in his own occupational duty, as ordered by the Supreme Lord, his sinful activities are certainly diminished. Therefore, if one is engaged in his occupational duty by force, he benefits because he can vanquish all his sinful activities in that way. Om Agnati Mirandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksurun Militam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Karamayam Dadati Svapadantikam. So this is the 5th canto, 10th chapter, 23rd verse. It's the verse I thought it was. There are a lot of interesting lessons to be learned from this verse, from this whole chapter. We see, for example, a king, one who is in the royal order, taking a position that is lower than someone who was lower than he was. He's a palanquin bearer. Then he also argues that even though he should see everything equally, he has to make distinctions between high and low. And therefore, sometimes he has to give orders, sometimes he has to chastise, sometimes he has to use force. And that is also beneficial, according to what he says. He also, Prabhupada mentions here, that it is the duty of a leader. And he mentions president, that our president is currently engaged in some slanderous activity or some alleged misdoing, to engage the citizens properly according to Krishna conscious activities and to protect them. Also, the, King Rahugan is arguing for the need to engage things like kingliness or leadership in the service of Krishna, something which ordinarily might not be very saintly. So there's a lot of things. Also, the being freed from attachment, Prabhupada mentions in the purport, and attachment and anger is a necessity in order to execute even material activities. So probably one of the most interesting things about this whole incident is the fact that King Rahugana has a very radical transformation occur. He takes a position lower than one who is his servant. So one example of this is Krishna himself. Of course, he does that. He's the, what is his position in relation to Arjuna? He's the driver. He becomes the person who is commanded instead of being the commander, even though he is the supreme commander. So he has this very radical transformation, and it takes place very rapidly. He just gives out a few instructions, or calls Jad Bharat a few names, tells him that he's not doing a good job, that he insults him, tells him that he, in sarcastic language, he says that you're not very stout and strong, but actually was by look. So he was being sarcastic. Why can't you walk? Why can't you carry the palanquin right? You don't seem very intelligent. Actually, he was very intelligent. So he insulted him in different ways. And Jad Bharat was very forthcoming, very forthright with him. He didn't care that he was a king. He didn't use diplomacy or mince words or say things that were flattering, but rather he more or less said in not so many words, but that you're not actually a king. Now that's a pretty great insult to tell a king that you're not really a king. That's what he said. You're thinking you're something in the royal order, but actually you're not that thing that you think you are. Nor am I what you think I am. I'm not the carrier of a palanquin. I'm not just some dumb, blind fool who can't understand things. So in a very short time, and with just a couple of verses, he began to explain to him what his position was, that actually there's a soul, there's a God that controls everything, and it's far beyond what we think we may be, that these are all illusory, temporary manifestations that we think we are. So in that very short period of time, because the king had some pious activity in his background, and because he appreciated absolute truth, he just did this amazing thing. He prostrated himself before his palanquin bearer and practically touched his feet with his head and asked him to forgive him and to accept him as his disciple. So here he was in 1 minute just ordering him what to do, where to go, how to, and insulting him. And then, practically speaking, the next minute, almost the very next second, he was offering his obeisances and considering him that he should be his spiritual master. Well, that's pretty radical, going from king to an obsequious kind of service attitude, or just accepting someone. But it also points up something that's not so unusual or so surprising, in that part of the need to advance ourselves in Krishna consciousness is advancing other people. We, just like Guru Maharaj, he didn't want to go back to the spiritual sky alone. He looked back to see, was his mother, who introduced him to Krishna consciousness, was she also coming along? Was she going back to Godhead? So similarly, we try to advance the cause of Krishna consciousness, not just become more Krishna conscious ourselves, but to widen the circle of Krishna consciousness, to bring more people back to Godhead with us. So in the course of doing that, sometimes we run into obstacles, and it's very common, especially in this age, that we run into many, many obstacles. After all, this is the age of Kali. It is being ruled by the Yugaraj Kali himself, and it's very difficult. So sometimes, and I've heard it on tape, people complain to Prabhupada, well, I'm preaching, I'm trying to spread Krishna consciousness, but people are, you know, not interested, they don't want to hear, or they're interested in something else. They go away. They seem to have some other agenda, and they're not really paying attention to what I'm saying. And in different ways, I heard it on a tape once, someone was complaining to Prabhupada, that people don't listen, even though I'm just speaking right from your books, the knowledge in these books. And Prabhupada, so what should I do? So Prabhupada said, if they were going to listen to you, there would be no point in preaching. If they heard you, if they accepted what you said, there would be no reason for you have to go out and try to spread Krishna consciousness, because everybody would already be Krishna conscious. So then he proceeded to say, after hearing further complaints, that some people were downright nasty and in fact, almost violent than Prabhupada. But some people we have to avoid because they're very inimical to Krishna consciousness. And then he quoted that verse, I think it's from the 11th canto, about the four different ways we should relate with devotees. One is Bali Sheshu Divishatsu Jat. That's the way, that's the quality of a Majjhima Adhikari. Ishvara Tadad Dineshu. One should make friends with the Supreme Lord. Worship the Supreme Lord. Make friends with the devotees. See all other people, third, as innocent. And fourth, avoid the envious. It's a very famous verse. So Prabhupada expounded on this verse at quite some length. Ishvara Tadad Dineshu. Bali Sheshu Divishatsu Jat. Prema Maitre Karapopekya. It's the qualities of a Majjhima Adhikari. Very famous verse. So he talked about, you worship the Supreme Lord, you consider all the innocent people, all people like Bali Sheshu, Dvishatsucha, that's like children. Bala means child. Sometimes we talk about Bala Krishna, we see the little Bala Krishna. He's a small child, Krishna, at 4 or 5 years old or less, eating a ladu. Sometimes they call him Ladu Krishna. So the vision of the Majjhima Adhikari is that such person sees everyone as innocent. So this kind of is the way that the king was seeing Jad Bharat. He was a palanquin bearer, maybe he was kind of stumbling around, stopping and going and moving in a circular fashion, in a zigzag fashion. And the other people couldn't keep up with him. But instead of just considering that he was a complete fool, he heard him. He had something to say, that I'm not really a palanquin bearer. And so in that very short time, he accepted, well, this person is a very highly elevated, advanced Brahmin Vaishnav. I must worship him. So this can happen anywhere. If we see Bali Sheshu Dvishatsuchat, everyone as children, as innocent, as people in need of Krishna consciousness, but not inherently evil or inimical, most people, then anyone who walks in the door, just like someone just walked in the door here, he could be our guru. I mean, we don't know who he is. We don't know what his karmic background is. I didn't even see what it was. Steep. Could be. So this is the kind of, we might say, the miracle of Krishna consciousness. What one casts out the seeds and you never know where they're going to land or what kind of tree is going to grow up, what kind of plant or bush or creeper or whatever. This is the amazing miracle of maintaining this Majjhima Adhikari attitude, that anyone can not only be a devotee, but can be a very advanced devotee. And this is what happened in this instance, the palanquin bearer became greater than the king, and the king offered his obeisances. Not only did he offer his obeisances, but he begged him to please forgive him. That's one of the other striking verses in this chapter. He begged and begged him in such a way. I'm not afraid, he said. I'm not afraid of the trident of Lord Shiva, or of the thunderbolt of Lord Vishnu, or of the scorching heat and rain and sun, and the punishments that Kuvera might meet upon us. I'm not afraid of any of those things, but I'm terrified of offending a Vaishnava. That was his great fear. He not only recognized him as his guru and offered him his dandabats and prayers and asked him for enlightenment, but he begged him to forgive all of his offenses and say that there's one thing that one needs to be greatly afraid of in this world, and it's not anything that you might think of, like the thunderbolt of Indra, but this great fear is to offend a Vaishnava. So we say that every day, that to blaspheme the devotees who have dedicated their lives to propagating holy names is a very grave offense, and the way those kinds of offenses are nullified is by seeking their forgiveness from the ones that have been offended. even Durvasa, when he was offensive to Maharaj Ambarish, he couldn't get even to Vishnu, Lord Vishnu, to forgive him, who is the most forgiving and most forbearing of all. He was chased by the chakra. We know that story, chased all over the universe. And still he couldn't get forgiveness, because he had to get forgiveness from the person he offended, who was Maharaj Ambarish. And Vaishnavas like Maharaj Ambarish, like Jad Bharat, they're very forgiving, very forbearing. When Durvasa went to beg forgiveness from Ambarish, and he very humbly begged forgiveness also. Maharaj Ambarish said, I not only forgive you, but I'll, whatever pious credits I've amassed, whatever I'm worth, I give to you. I just immediately give it to you. He was so forgiving that he didn't even think twice. He just said, whatever I have, whatever good merits I've accumulated in my past, it all goes to you. So there's no question of even having to forgive. You just take whatever I have. It's all yours. Just imagine how magnanimous someone is. Just think of just giving your camera or your car to someone. It's practically unthinkable. But he said, whatever I have, just take it. It's all yours. Even though he was greatly offended, and this Durvasa had the power to curse him in so many things. So the king was very keen to get his forgiveness. And this is a wonderful dialogue that he began to hear transcendental knowledge. He realized that he wasn't actually the king, that there was something more, something greater to his existence, and he began to seek forgiveness. And he became, in effect, a disciple of Jad Bharat. Of course, Jad Bharat was no ordinary person. He was definitely a living saint and the kind of person one would want to take shelter of. So he was later on, as we're reading in this verse, making the argument that sometimes we have to make distinctions. He says, even though such relationships are temporary, when a person takes the position of king, he has to punish sometimes the citizens to get them to act in a certain way. So this is also a principle that earlier on Prabhupada is arguing that is sometimes employed in Mayavadi arguments, that people say that we shouldn't make any distinctions. There's no need to ever do any kind of punishment or for a capitalist to try to make money or to be a little dishonest or whatever, because everything is one. And this is one of the arguments that everyone who's into this Mayavadi philosophy would argue, that everyone should be the same because everyone is the same, and therefore you don't make distinctions. So of course Prabhupada's movement is different inasmuch as he uses the example of Arjuna. Arjuna had the very unhappy task of having to fight a war, and his mood was that I shouldn't do it. But he did do it, and in doing so, Prabhupada mentions that he performed a not very adorable act, the act of fighting, in the service of the Lord, the act of chastising, because it was a way of showing that whatever one does, it can be used in the service of the Lord. Even something seemingly so abominable as being violent, that even something so extreme as that could be used in the service of Krishna. So in the case of a king who has to administer justice and rule and act in ways that people may not find very adorable or very acceptable, still, if he's doing so in the service of the Lord, then his activity becomes purified. So there are different types of administration. One is the godly or the Daivi Varnashram, and one is the Varnashram or the types of activity that we see around us, that we see our present administration. I think Prabhupada said earlier in this chapter, it may have been this chapter, but in somewhere he says that the Rajarshis, the way they ruled, they were kingly, saintly kings. Their rule was like heaven, whereas the present rulers rule and they create a hell out of the situation. So if the ruler is not God-conscious, you have a kind of hellish situation in which the whole society becomes like hell. And if the ruler is God-conscious, the whole society is very saintly and very pure. It becomes heavenly. So it's also mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Atakpumbir Dvijashreshtas Vanashrama Vibhagasha, that one can satisfy the Supreme Lord by doing one's prescribed duties. Sangsidim Haritoshan. The Supreme Lord is actually pleased and happy, and this is the way that one can attain perfection. So Prabhupada has exempted everyone from having to go to the Himalayas barefoot to meditate, to become pure and perfect, and said that wherever you are, whatever you're doing, right here and now, even though you may have not a very adorable occupation, almost anything, if it's done expertly and it's done in accordance with the orders of the Supreme Lord as he's constructed duties to be done, then one can attain perfection. So in our present situation, we live in a very contaminated time, in a very contaminated place. Still, we can attain perfection. And by attaining perfection, or working towards perfection, we can influence other people to want to attain perfection. So the Rajarshis, they'll not exist in this world, in this time, because of Kali Yuga. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada said it's up to the devotees of the Krishna Consciousness Movement to adopt those qualities, to become saintly, and therefore thereby influence many, many people, even including those who are leaders of society. So Maharaj Rahugana was very happy when he came to his senses and he saw that this palanquin bear was only gyrating and zigzagging because he was trying to avoid killing the ants. Sometimes we forget that Krishna is Hambija Pradapita, Bija Mam Sarvabhutanam. He's the father of all living entities. And that must naturally, because he claims that, Aham Bija Pradapita, that must naturally include all who are non-humans. And that would include even the little creatures of the ground, the ants, and of course all the fish and the aquatics and everything else. So when devotees are known for not wanting to harm animals, there's a reason that every animal, every living being, has a right to live out its prescribed term. And interfering with that term, interfering with those laws, creates difficulty. So the king had this kind of higher sense that this was actually all right, that even though his palanquin bear was giving him a rough ride, that he had a good reason for doing it. Because he could see, as a king, he had the sense that these ants were also citizens of the kingdom. Just as in opposition, today we see that there's no sense that the animals are citizens of this country, for example. There's no sense of that. There's a big case going on between Oprah Winfrey and some Texas cattlemen. And there's no sense that these cows, cattle, are protectable, that they need protection, that they are citizens of the state. So millions and millions are being slaughtered. And the whole question is not about whether it's wrong to kill cows. And this is a big, high-profile court case. Millions and millions of dollars are being involved in that. In the state of Texas, this is going on. There's no thought or no mention anywhere about the rightness or wrongness about slaughtering animals. It's all about whether or not laws that say you can't disparage a particular type of food is constitutional or not. So it's become kind of a big beef versus big industry, big media, I guess. That's what it's all about, really. So it'll probably go to the Supreme Court and they'll rule on whether or not you can say bad things about broccoli or oranges or meat. It's lumped into that category. That's what's going to happen. But of course, in the course of all this, in the next 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 weeks, however long it takes, a lot is going to come out about the dangers, about the health dangers anyway. People don't understand the karmic or ethical values, but they can understand that there's certain economic and health and environmental forces that are important, that one should know about. So devotees kind of watch something like this with a bit of a muted interest, you might say, to find out, you know, how people are going to react, if they're going to stop. And of course, if they reduce their meat eating or stop, number of people stop, as Prabhupada says in the first canto, when he talks about the appearance of Lord Buddha, that unless people stop the horrible process of animal killing, they can't understand the first principles of God consciousness. He gives emphasis when he writes that. It's in italics. So there's some interest there. But it's very amazing that, I mean, to us as devotees, that people in government positions don't see that if you're not a human being, you don't count. You don't have a vote, so you don't count. You don't need to be protected. Whether it's a cow or a horse or an ant, just you don't count. You don't have any position. So this is where saintliness comes into the picture, where people like Jad Bharat and devotees have something important to say, that it's another dimension that you don't kill. It's wrong to kill animals. It's not proper because they belong. They're citizens too. They don't have to be able to vote. They're sentient. They have feelings. So one thing that's mentioned here is that one of the reasons that Maharaj Rahugana respected so much Jad Bharat is that Jad Bharat had inherited, it mentions, all the qualities of Kapiladeva. Of course, Kapiladeva was considered an incarnation of Krishna and gave very, very detailed and pertinent knowledge about how one should act. He talked about tolerance, Chitiksha, Karuna, Kasurida, Sarvadehinam, Ajata Saptavashanta. That's one of his famous verses, that one should be tolerant, merciful, Pratiksha Karunaka Suhridam, should be the friend of everyone, should not be inimical towards anyone. So these are all the qualities that he imbibed, that Bharat had. He wasn't inimical. He even though he was insulted, he actually didn't feel he didn't feel like he wanted to retaliate. He was just going through life, like taking insults one after the other, not talking. Can you imagine what it's like if you never talk to anyone? And there's one devotee I know who doesn't talk when he eats. Just doesn't do that. And that's okay, because scripturally you can defend that. You can, you know, take him prasadam is very sacred. But still, a lot of people don't like him. They get on his case because he doesn't talk. I don't say they don't like him, but they just feel weird. You know, they want to talk to him. They speak to him and he doesn't talk back. It's okay. But just imagine going through life, your whole life, never talking, not only when you're not eating, but ever, just not talking. And this is what Jad Bharat was doing. And so he got all kinds of insult heaped upon him. But he never retaliated. He never felt like, you know, inimical. He never had any hatred. There's an incident where Prabhupada was on a radio program, and a lady called in. It was one of these call-in shows, and she started out by saying, "Where's your so-called temple?" You know, like that. That just that kind of a tone. "And where do you get your money?" And Prabhupada was answering in a way that was just completely dispassionate. "Oh, my temple's located in such and such a place, and many people donate, they give money." And, you know, on and on. She was going like that. And finally she said, "Oh, so you're a freeloader, huh?" And Prabhupada said, "Yes." He said it with a very deep ringing tone that I can't do, but he said it in such a way that everyone who was listening could tell that he was not at all affected. He didn't feel any anger. He didn't feel any sense of having to retaliate. He didn't feel uncomfortable. He felt this is all, you know, just another facet of life. And he was so pacific, so calm, that the person who was running the program became irritated at the woman, who up to that time he wasn't really very irritated with, and he said, "I'm going to punch her out," which meant he was going to push a button that cut her off from the telephone line into the radio station. So that quality is very wonderful. Pratiksha Karuna, it's tolerance and mercy. And even though one may be insulted, Prabhupada gives the example of Lord Jesus Christ. He was crucified. He never insulted. Haridas Thakur was beaten severely in all 23 or so marketplaces. And when his tormentors said that they were going to die if they didn't bring back his dead body, he went into a kind of trance, as if he were dead, just to satisfy those people, and kind of disappeared for a while. So these are very extreme, you know, qualities that we can't hope to maybe attain in this lifetime. But nonetheless, these are the qualities that King Rahugana found very worshipable in Jad Bharat, and which we actually have to aspire to. And I mean, Prabhupada said that some devotees could go back to Godhead in one lifetime if they did certain things. So it's not completely unattainable. Anyway. I think we can stop there. Unless maybe somebody would like to say some things, some make some comments or have some things. Yes. Yeah, it's good to control the tongue, and that's done in different ways. It's controlled by what we eat and what we say. So if we can go without talking, if we can talk less, silence is one of the qualifications of a devotee mentioned in Chaitanya Charitamrita. There's a list of qualifications, and one of them is silence. Of course, Prabhupada says that silence is just speaking about Krishna and chanting the Maha Mantra. But if you can undergo that kind of, what we call a mauna, vow of silence, and be in a place where you're not going to agitate people or, you know, be agitated yourself, then it's good, because it's a way to control the tongue. I knew someone that did that. He carried a board everywhere, and, you know, he was... Huh? Mayor Baba, and there was one of his followers also. A boy used to come to the L.A. temple. Huh? Yeah. 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 So that's a way you can do it. Yeah. Right. Yeah, they say, I don't know if it's true, but they say elephants are, they're actually very wild, and they trample and kill people until they get trained, and then they're very, very gentle, and they protect people. So we deal with all just like this King Mahogany is mentioning, that in order to administer justice, or just to be an administrator, one has to do things that aren't necessarily very palatable or kind. You know, sometimes having to force, rule the citizens, punish those disobedient. So you have to have a police force to deal with certain elements in society. So even though we see that animals are worthy of respect because the super soul's in there, still they have to be. You know, we don't let the dogs come in and eat off our plate and stuff like that. We make distinctions. And these distinctions, when they're done in a Krishna-conscious way, according to Krishna-conscious rulings, then they're okay, even though they may seem to contradict some of the saintly ways in which we should be looking at things. Do they? Yeah, this is good, a good point. The question, I don't know if it should be repeated. I guess. Anyway, the point was raised, a very, very good point, was that even though he offered his surrender and his dandabat, that he, which is a sign of I'll do whatever you say, and whatever you say is right, and I'm not going to argue with you anymore. He presented various arguments about having to rule and punish disobedient people and rule the citizens. So it's explained in Bhagavad Gita that Tadvidi Pranipatina, that one should seek out a spiritual master, inquire from him, submissively render service unto him, and such an elevated soul can impart knowledge to you because he's seen the truth. But this it justifies asking questions, and questions aren't necessarily defiant. Questions are ways of getting a deeper understanding. Arjuna actually had his questions too, but they were kind of before they were asked. You know, he presented all the arguments before, but they can also be presented after, because the relationship between guru and disciple is ongoing. It's an ongoing and eternal relationship, in fact. And sometimes there is this kind of give and take. And one somewhat related aspect of this is that after the conversation, Arjuna became the commander of Krishna. He didn't defy him, but he kind of told him what to do, which is, you know, that's a very unusual situation. You know, take me here, take me there. He was the driver. So it's not at all unusual or uncustomary for a disciple or anyone who's a genuine seeker of spiritual knowledge to ask, well, there appears to be contradictions. I have to rule, so what do I do? So surrender doesn't mean blind and unthinkingness. It means understanding who I am, where I'm going, what is nature, what I'm doing, what, you know, and how to do what I'm doing in a way that's spiritual. So he had this job of being a king, which wasn't an easy thing to do and be saintly. So he was in a sense arguing, but he was really, what he was doing was inquiring, what do I do? I have to punish, I have to rule, and how can, and it seems like I have to do that. So how do I do it and still be a saintly person? It's not. This is the wonderful thing that Prabhupada brought. He not only brought jnana, the knowledge in the books, but he brought vijnana. He showed by his example how we could apply our intelligence, our activities, and they may not be very savory, but wherever we are, wherever we're at, he demonstrated and taught in his purports, which is called Vijnana, how the knowledge of Krishna consciousness could actually be applied where we are. We don't. In other words, he used to say so many times, if you're a painter, paint for Krishna. If you're whatever you do, do it for Krishna. If you're a carpenter, if you're a fixer, if you're an artist, just do it for Krishna. And of course, there's a lot more to it than that. But he opened the door to this kind of inquiry. And even though it may be foolish, just like was it Sanatana Goswami went to Lord Chaitanya, and his very first words when he came for instruction was at Varanasi, he said, "Kayani, who am I?" So even though he had so much knowledge, and so that knowledge was put aside, but at the same time he was inquiring, what do I do? And then he instructed him, not only in the science of devotional service. It would be abhorrent for anyone to think of 40, 50,000 or a million puppy dogs being killed every day. But that's how many pigs, cows are being killed. It's very strange. Someone, yeah. Genevieve? Go ahead. The live traps. Or get a cat, keep the mice population down. Or get a cat to keep the mice population down. Yeah. 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 Well, this is something that's very—it's difficult to research. I mean, maybe Dravida can enlighten us a little bit on that. But I'll give some examples I know from Prabhupada. At least one very poignant one that deals with mosquitoes. Now, someone might ask, well, how did a mosquito get into that body in the first place? Or, do we have to love mosquitoes? That reminds me, I'll try not to digress too far, but I was on, Dennis Prager he's a talk show host. His show goes to about 8 or 9 states. So I was on there once with a rabbi and a priest and a father, different religions. And the question of the day was, in your religion, are you allowed to hate? And the object of hate was a particular serial killer who was at that time running around strangling women or something. I think they caught him. Anyway, this was what the whole program was about. Are you allowed to hate and can you forgive? So it touches on this a little bit, that some animals seem to be like rats and cockroaches and mosquitoes. They seem to be pests and we kind of look down upon them. We don't see them as equal. Well, there's one incident where Prabhupada was in the temple in the manor, and one devotee there was a problem with rats there, and Prabhupada was just leaving, and he ran up to him as he was getting in his car and said, "Prabhupada, can we kill the rats?" And Prabhupada, without a beat missing, said, "You should be killed," just like that. I was so shocked, And later on, we got mice, and we were keeping the place clean, we got cats, and we were keeping the place clean, and Prabhupada approved of that. But one thing that I remembered was when he was being massaged by Shudakirti, and he'll tell you the story, and it's written in some of his diaries, is is that mosquitoes were getting on Prabhupada's body when he was massaging him. And Prabhupada said, you can kill them because they're aggressors. He said, why? He said, why can we kill them? He said, because they're aggressors. So he actually sanctioned them, you know, slapping them, squishing them on when they were trying to sting. So that was the question, was, you know, can we do this? And Prabhupada said, it's okay. And then there was a pause, and he said, because they're aggressors. So there, you know, we can consider the cockroaches and the mice and, you know, kind of aggressors, or when we put a big thing over the house and they come to, what do they call it, fumigate it or get rid of the cockroaches, that we're dealing with an aggressor. And in a way, it's kind of hinging on something we're reading here about dealing with aggression. I mean, aggression is definitely one of the reasons that that allows one to become violent, according to Bhagavad Gita. And it's a way also of dealing with different entities, you know, kind of like jiva jiva sujivanam, like the cat is there instead of having a, you know, a horrible trap. And Prabhupada knew there were sometimes cats and dogs on the temple grounds. Just for the reasons they were there, he knew, and he was sanctioning it. But, you know, as far as some scriptural evidence, right. Right. Probably we'll find some things in the law of Manu that talk about how to deal with different invading, aggressive, or insects and so-called, you know, because it is a form of aggression, you know, like certain animals eat the crops that you're going to eat, and so many things like that. Or you can carry it to an extreme and let the ants eat your body, like Irani Kashivu, and keep the life there in the bones. But this comes under the category of being practical, I think. And this is what Prabhupada knew, that sometimes devotees were fumigating and doing things like this, and he accepted it. But he didn't want to encourage it to the point where, like this one devotee who wanted to know if we could kill the mice. So it's important that we be very careful in all these things. Another thing too that came up once was, well, what about the ants? You're going to inevitably kill ants because you have to walk. And you're going to breathe, so you're going to kill some living beings that survive in the air. There's certain kinds of microbes that live. And there are people that wear a kind of a, it's like a surgical mask. I don't know, I think they're Jain people. Because they're very strict. They don't want to harm anybody. But what Prabhupada said about things like that is the unavoidable killing is that if you're chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, even though you might step on an ant, you might inhale and thereby kill a small creature, that you're purifying their existence, and they'll get a better opportunity in the next life to advance, you know, up to, you know, circumvent many maybe levels of evolution, of consciousness evolution, and come to a higher position. So one of the secrets is to always chant, and you know, just never let the holy name not be on the tongue. It's part of always remembering Krishna, never forgetting him. If we're always remembering to chant no matter what we're doing. One that Dennis was telling me, that if you grit your teeth too much, it can cause pockets of what do you call it, infection under the gums, you know, inflammation. And Yeah, he was telling one of his patients, some of his patients, that you know, just have sometimes you do that in your sleep. It's not good. It can cause abscesses and that sort of thing. So I was just thinking when I heard that, if you're chanting Hare Krishna all the time, then you know, if you get really accustomed to it, then even in your sleep you won't be gritting your teeth. You'll just be, you know, nice and fluid and doing what the mouth is supposed to be doing. You know, it's not supposed to be gritting its teeth. That's the sign of something wrong there. You know, it's tension. But if you're always chanting, it's a way of, you know, being very very hygienic and being very kind to your body. And there's just so many benefits in chanting that we can't even begin to list them. But that's, you know, kind of a base level. So I think we'll stop there. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.